and you sent for them, and they're going to be an adult by the time they come here. So it causes a lot of problems to have these families separated for so many years. So the idea of the Haitian Family Reunification Parole Program is to bring these families together. Even though there's a quota of visas that they give out every year, at least they would be able to do the rest of their wait over here in the States with their family members. And in the same way that the program was created for Cuban families back in 2007, and that was the program that was used for Leverett. So Black Immigration Network took on the campaign last year in May at their national kinship meeting as one of the two major campaigns that they were pushing for, and gave a really strong final push, but a nationwide push through the network. And, you know, happy to say that on October 17th, President Obama announced this executive action to pass the Haitian Family Reunification Parole Program. So that what that means is about 5,000 people who are expecting visas in the next couple of years would be able to be invited to enter the U.S. and finish their wait for the visa waiting list, the backlog waiting list, together with their families. But the problem is, when they did pass it, it took a while for the regulations to come out, and they came out with exorbitant fees for these programs that did not apply to the program that they had for the Cuban family reunification program. So some of the cases that we're seeing at Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees in New York, there are people that have four or five people to come in, and you know, you have to pay. There's a fee of $360 to come in, another fee of $380 to get your work authorization. And then when your visa is available, you have to pay $1,040. Of course, you have other costs that are associated, because when they get these invitation letters, they have to go. If you're in the countryside in Haiti, you have to go to Port-au-Prince,
right,
and be there for a few days to have your appointment with the U.S. Embassy, and then you have medical appointments, and then, of course, there are the airfare. So imagine if you have a few kids and you have
a lot of money.
Fees. Yeah. In the case of the Cubans, they didn't have all these fees.
No, it was just the wet foot, dry foot kind of thing, right?
Exactly. So we did have a small victory with this executive action. However, we have a lot more work to do in monitoring this program and pushing so that they, one, allow more folks to come in, because the numbers are much lower than what they allow for the Cubans. I believe it's around 20,000 and only 5,000 for Haitians.
Wow.
We're not even sure that it's going to be 5,000, so we have to monitor that because
yeah.
We started.
I don't want to get your name right. Is it Ninash?
Ninash,
sorry. Ninash. Let me get it together. Ninash. I should have written it down.
Yeah.
Ninash. Now, there's been somewhat of a long history of kind of a discrimination between Haitians coming into the U.S. and, as you described earlier, the question of Cubans into the United States, even prior to this, example that you gave us.
Sure.
You know, many times we saw boatloads of Haitians,
right,
who had some legitimate political strife that they were either running from, who were turned down, sent
mm-hmm.
back, you know, and yeah. many, and as we look at the situation in the Mediterranean, we hear it in the news, we know that a lot of Haitians also drowned trying to just get to the United States without the kind of rescue, without the kind of assistance that you talked about. And I should clarify it for people who maybe don't know that Cubans who make it to the United States illegally or without legal sanction, so to speak, without getting first a visa from the country of origin, when they arrive, automatically are given the pathway
yep.
to citizenship and are not sent back if they make it to the get their feet
right.
on the ground,
right. yep.
As opposed to being in the water, where that was never afforded to Haitian immigrants.
That's correct. There was a time when Jimmy Carter was president,
mm.
and he came with this Cuban-Haitian program. Program, and for that short time, it was afforded to both Haitians and Cubans. But in the early 80s when Rudolph Giuliani, who used to be the mayor in New York, back then he was the assistant attorney general, he drew up a treaty between the U.S. and then president of the United States, the president of Haiti, known as Baby Duck, Jean-Claude Duvalier, signed this treaty saying that they could repatriate Haitians, so the U.S. Coast Guard could pick them up when they left by boat and force them to repatriate them to Haiti right away. So that's when that short period that Haitians were afforded the same rights as Cubans, so that this life of love ended. So it was very brief. It was a very brief option for Haitians when Jimmy Carter was president, but Giuliani drew up a treaty to end that. And since then, since the early 80s, for the most part, Haitians have been forcibly returned to Haiti. There was another period after the first, when President Aristide, the first democratically elected president, was overthrown in September of 91,
yeah.
Where they did open up, there was a bloody coup that was, of course, backed by the U.S., and they did open up Guantanamo and allowed for a number of Haitians that left by boat to be screened to see if they're allowed to come into the United States to apply for political asylum. So that was a brief period, the end of 91 and through June of 92. And about 40,000 Haitians went through there, but about one-fourth of them were allowed to continue to the United States to apply for political asylum.
Exactly. Again, this is 89.3 FM WRFG Atlanta, and we're going to take a brief break. Sister Tia and Sister Nina, should we be right back in a few minutes? So if you can stay with us, that would be much appreciated.
Sure. Get ready for the Culture Fest of the season, brought to you by WRFG Radio with support from BondFest 2015. Saturday, May 2nd, 8 p.m., you're invited to Zimbabwe Land and Freedom Party, a night of live music, food, crafts, and rich culture, featuring the Mellow Groove Band, the Sounds of Love Child, featuring the Soul Fighters, Rastafunk, Permaculture, featuring Aja Ray, Rashida Ali, the All Nice and Decent Crew, Saeed Malik, and introducing Amandi J. Taking place in the Paul Robeson Theater of the Arts Exchange, conveniently located at 57 Cap Street, Southeast Atlanta, in the East Atlanta Village. Sound provided by DJ Rebellion, Firearms, and DJ Loki, with a special surprise guest. Enjoy food, vending, the African marketplace, and relaxation in the healing room, featuring chair massage, Reiki, foot massage, and aromatherapy. For vending and sponsorship, the number is 404-590-8010, and the website is bobfestatl.com. Advance tickets only $10 for this spring fling, featuring three bands, Pan-African sounds, live DJs, cultural food, and good company. This is a fundraiser benefit for Atlanta's radio station for progressive information and handpicked quality music. WRFG 89.3 FM. www.wifg.org. Get ready for a party to remember, celebrating Zimbabwe's independence and Bob Marley's historic performance on April 18th, 1980. It all takes place Saturday, May 2nd. Proceeds benefit WRFG Radio. So this has been a public service announcement brought to you by your listener-supported station for progressive information, WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM.
All right, and we want to welcome you back to Beyond Borders, the People of the Caribbean, Latin America. Today, we're speaking with Sisters Nina and Tia, Ninaj and Tia from the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, speaking about the plight that face Haitian people. Now, you mentioned people being turned back on the high seas, and Sibukwe mentioned the Mediterranean. People were... The terrorization of these people who would get on these boats with their families, something maybe you need to touch on a little, that people were not just coming just to get a better job, well, that's part of it, but they were running for their lives. and still are in, you know, hence some of the tragedies that we see on the border with Mexico, in relation to Honduras, for instance, for example, or in the Mediterranean. Can you speak a little about these root causes that drive people here?
Yes, definitely. So, just as you're sharing, a lot of the reasons why people will risk migration and really risk their lives, right, on these higher Camarilla pirate ships, rafts and things of that nature is because of not only economic instability in their countries and inability to provide for their families, but a lot of times, and more often because of political persecution and violence in their home countries. And so we see not only happening in Haiti right here in the Americas and the Caribbean, but in the Mediterranean. We see alone the number of migrants who lost their lives is already up to over 1,500 in the European Union governments that have an emergency tribunal to discuss emergency summit to discuss, you know, the situation. Particularly in Mali and Eritrea, the civil wars, and then also throughout North Africa, the types of unrest, and then also the fallout that comes from Syria and the other political coups and civil wars that are happening, all really driving folks to take food for their lives. And they're willing to risk, you know, death at sea in order to, for the chance, right, just the chance to get to safety, and they're seeking asylum. The asylum process, particularly in Europe, is very narrow and very complicated. Only a certain number of countries, only a handful of countries actually accept asylum cases. The folks who are able to, you know, make the passage and survive the passage are immediately put into detention. They call them reception centers, but we refer to them as a detention center for months and sometimes years, and many times only to be sent back, right? And then even if you are able to make it, if you are able to, you know, some people escape being detained, and they go into, you know, living as undocumented in their countries, and just even here in the U.S., if someone is undocumented, you know, they're not able to work, right, not able to access services, not a lot of times having to live, you know, a life relegated on the margins. And immediately, if you are found out, risking, you know, certain detention or arrest or deportation, something is happening in Europe. And Spain and Israel, where you have African migrants who are, if they are able to get asylum or if they're living undocumented, are facing staunch racial and xenophobic persecution, violence. Folks who are living legally and authorized, right, either, you know, as migrants or as, you know, political or humanitarian refugees are being denied as public accommodations. They're having they're being evicted, they're being fired from their job, they're being driven out of their communities. And so we see this happening, the parallels are very similar, but a lot of it, the majority of it is as a result of both political and economic marginalization and persecution in their home countries, making their home countries unlivable, and the people without country at this point, who are being kind of, you know, forced around, and left at risk at home or abroad or in transit, and while they're migrating, women are facing sexual violence as well. And then you have our governments who, instead of discussing the humanitarian crisis and figuring out how to respond, are discussing enforcement, are discussing, you know, punitive measures, are talking about buildings, you know, larger detention centers and things of that nature. And it's just a really, that's a really heart-wrenching, right, heart-wrenching situation that's happening, and it's happening all over the world.
And, I mean, some might argue that, so why should, quote-unquote, we, Europe or the United States pay for it? And there's an article, a country like Malta, for instance, with I know how small the population is, saying, heard some of the commentator saying, you know, we can't take all these Nigerians, Eritreans. Why, what's the argument as to why the chaos in Libya, for instance, would have something to do, some obligation that should rest within the U.S. or Europe?
So
So a lot of the circumstances that cause unrest and drive down wages and remove economic access have to do with U.S. foreign policy, as well as economic policy, particularly environmental crises that happen as a result of development, foreign development, right? Some of the reasons why home countries are not livable for them. And so we definitely do that. If we're able to, you know, allow corporations and governments access to disrupt foreign governments and foreign economies and displace people, I feel that we definitely would bear the responsibility, right, of the humanitarian ramifications of that. Like when we say, you know, people are allowed to move, we allow companies to move goods and services and resources, but we don't allow people that same access, right, that free same access to movement.
Ninaz, were you gonna? Yeah, okay. Ninaz,
yeah.
Getting back to Haiti in particular, because you kind of mentioned earlier that, you know, there was an overthrow of Aristide in 1991, and again, of course, in
2004.
There are a couple things that, in terms of lately, I understood that there were some Haitian communities that have been questioning some of the candidates, particularly current I'm talking about Clinton.
The U.S.
The presidential candidates here in the U.S. The whole question of the Clintons and their role, and particularly in the resource allocation, the millions and billions of dollars that supposedly would come into Haiti. That has not yet been accounted for. There are many Haitians here who are challenging some of those scenarios. Has there been any conversation with Hillary, as you know, or as a candidate, about her role and what she thinks and how they would approach the question of Haitian reunification, immigration in general?
Right. Well, there is a group that protests in front of Hillary just got new headquarters in Brooklyn, New York. And so there's a group of Haitians that protest in front of her office regularly since she's moved there just a few weeks ago. And what they're protesting is, why they're protesting her candidacy is because of the hand that her and her husband, Bill Clinton, had in bringing Haiti to the situation it is now after the earthquake. As you know, Bill Clinton was named special envoy to the UN. Right. Obama made him responsible for all the funds that would come in, the aid funds that would come in for Haiti. And so everything came through him. A great part also went through his Clinton Global Initiative that was run by that family. And they would have conferences, you know, just shortly after the earthquake, where people would come to these hotels in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and basically buy parts of Haiti. It was like Haiti was for sale, you know. So they bought some parts themselves. They sold, you know, it was just like literally selling the country, anything of value.
You said that the Clintons?
Yes, they bought property themselves. And then when the election happened afterwards, the president that's there now, Michel Martelly, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, so she literally went down on a one-day trip on one Monday, I remember clearly, and basically handpicked him and said, this is going to be, you know, there was supposed to be a runoff election, and he was not one of the top three candidates. He was not one of the top two candidates. He would have been the third one. So the woman, Mrs. Monica, was the second candidate. One of the top two candidates, she sort of removed her and put, she took her and this guy, Michel Martelly, who's president now, and decided that those two are going to be the runoff candidates for, where he wasn't even one of the top two candidates. And then it was just a setup to make him president, because I guess that they felt like they would be able to do whatever they want with Haiti if he became president. So, and essentially they started, you know, advancing their agenda to to exploit Haiti to the maximum, you know. And this dates back to when Clinton was president, there was a policy that was passed where excess rice, you know, from the farmers over here mm-hmm. would be dumped in Haiti, and then prices would be subsidized in the market, which basically put all the rice farmers in Haiti out of business. So there's no reason why Haiti shouldn't be able to grow their own rice. We always had our own rice. It's better quality rice. And the rice that's being dumped from the U.S. is bad white rice that, you know, that caused people to get diabetes. We didn't used to see these rates of diabetes in Haiti before. And it's a problem. You know, they're dumping fish, too. They're dumping all kinds of fish in Haiti. We're putting the local fishers out of business, too. So I think if there's, like you mentioned earlier, I think as far as the responsibility of the U.S. for taking refugees, I think if at least there were some sovereignty in these countries where the U.S. did not impose their agendas on these countries and dump their excess, you know, agriculture products in these countries and allow these countries to be more independent and sustainable, then people wouldn't have to leave, you know, whether it's for political or economic reasons. You know, we sit here and choose whether or not people should be refugees based on whether they were leaving for political or economic reasons, but the two, you know, I never understood that because the two are related. You know, the politics really dictates what's going to happen economically. Even though a lot of the Haitian refugees that come here are fleeing political persecution, but, you know, as far as folks that are having economic issues, this is why. It's because we have to put up with these policies that are forced on us. Uh-huh.
So
the globalization.
Yeah, so earlier...
this is Jovan speaking.
Yeah, this is Jovan speaking. Also of Haitian descent. So earlier, there was some commentary about, you know, I think that we're speaking specifically of the European situation, but how, you know, a lot of times citizens of these countries from the global north, from these Western countries, will ask the question, why should we bear the burden of these immigrant populations who are seeking refuge from countries? And I think that conversation is largely usually accounted for because there's this belief that things that happen in your country are totally under your control. Do you guys see any way to shift the conversation and to help get citizens in the global north, citizens of the U.S., citizens of Europe, to take responsibility for, you know, for their government's actions, let's say, not just in the politics they support, but in taking policy decisions such as supporting American farmers dumping their rice in Haiti and causing, you know, national disasters on a national scale?
Right, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just even programs like this, right? So educating folks who are unconscious about the situation, right? And then figuring out how we, because there are certain policies that cause turmoil in governments and societies abroad, they do the same things here, driving away economic opportunities, you know, I've talked about the kind of health implications, right, of the different agricultural practices. So I think part of it is having these discussions and helping to educate ourselves and one another about the issues and then seeing how they're connected. And then also really being really honest about, you know, whose interests are being served and that's what organizing is about, is taking these situations, you know, to those individuals. And so the group that's protesting in front of Hillary Clinton's campaign headquarters, right, they're calling attention to the situation, right there, you know, speaking truth to power. So that's also a part of it, is, you know, using the platforms and the leverage, especially as, you know, folks are, you know, definitely if folks are seeking the elected office, pushing certain policies, and, you know, calling attention to these things and holding folks to account. I think for a lot of different reasons, we're not necessarily, you know, in the business of electoral politics. But for a lot of different reasons, Hillary Clinton left the office is going to bring a lot of these issues to the forefront in a way that they haven't been paid attention to if we, you know, capitalize on the attention that is being put on, you know, her as an individual.
Yeah.
Go.
Well, I think we might be going to the same question. This seems to me to be a direct connection between the Obama administration.
administration's intervention in Libya, supposedly the right to protect or whatever it was that the UN clause that they used, and the chaos that followed. So, you know, I think, yes, their governments has to be held accountable for the chaos. Whether or not you agree or, you know, with who should be the president of Honduras, the fact that the type of intervention that we've had, the impact on these populations, means that I think there should be some responsibility for the governments. So I think there's a direct connection between, and you mentioned just briefly on the Haitian situation, was there a issue too with the livestock, with the pigs in Haiti also, where there was a particular initiative that really undermined the local pig farming situation?
Sure, yeah. What are called the Creole pigs, that were the black pigs, were riches for farmers and for the peasants in Haiti. But at some point, there was a period called Nizete. It's called Nizete in Haiti, where the Americans basically came in and said that these pigs are not healthy for you, that they're sick, and they came in and killed a lot of the black pigs, and then they came in with all these pink pigs. And,
if it wasn't true, people would think you made that up, but yeah.
But it's so true, and this is, with these black pigs, these are really people's riches, and this is how people are able to send their kids to school and support their families. And, you know, people did hide, some were able to hide the black pigs, because when I go to Haiti today, I do see black pigs. I don't see the pink pigs, I see the black pigs. But, and people were aware, you know, of what was going on. And then if we talk about the disasters, the problems that we have with so-called natural disasters, you know, this dates back again, when the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, for 19 years, the U.S. Marines were there. Whether they said, for whatever reason, that they didn't want the Germans to come back or something, whether they give different reasons why they occupied Haiti, but while they were there, they cleaned out the gold reserves, and they chopped down the best trees of Haiti, you know, three-quarters of the trees in Haiti, and shipped them back here for lumber. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like those trees were over 100 years. That wasn't even quite 100 years ago that they started coming in there, 1919 to 1934. And it's not like they replanted the trees. So now when there are floods, you know, there are storms and hurricanes and there are floods, that's why we have this erosion problem. They blame it on the peasants, and they say that the peasants are chopping down the trees and using it for cooking coal. But the fact is, the peasants don't have the kind of equipment to chop down those huge trees that were chopped down back then. And what they did, you know, the lumber industry comes in and does, like they've done in Brazil and so many other countries.
So basically, you know, this is really a discussion about the relationship of development to underdevelopment, and then what happens and what drives immigration. I think that's where we're going, and certainly we can look at the same situation, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it much, the end of the status of folks in the Dominican Republic. But on a kind of a final note, a wrap up, we want to again address the campaigns that are going on for family reunification, and how we are people, I should say, are able to get involved, and how we can, how the Haitian community can, and those of us who support the Haitian community can come together. Are there any conferences or any, I know that there at one point in time was some letter writing campaigns, some petition campaigns, but where are we, and what is the best way that people can get involved?
So this is the thing to get involved. Always is to join Black Immigration Network, as you're specifically interested in the Haiti campaign. We have a campaign website, www.reunitehaitianfamilies.com, where we have the petition about implementation folks can sign on to, as well as we're asking for community organizations and businesses and elected officials to endorse the campaign. And that's all on reunitehaitianfamilies.com. www.cubanmusicmagazine.com. And then also we're going to be we share regular updates on the implementation, asking folks to share the good information as much as possible, so that folks are not taken in by, you know, scams and frauds. The program as it stands now is only available to people who are particularly invited by USCIS, so it's important that people know that and that they have their contact information up to date. And we have all that information on the website as well. And then also we're going to be continuing to, as the program progresses, we're going to continue organizing around, and we're going to be looking for organizations and allies and partners in the community that have looked up these issues, just as we were discussing on today. Looked up how all these issues are interconnected, and around this is a priority, and how the policies toward changes do need to change, and how they are, in what ways they're discriminatory. Because this is about race strategies, this is about racial justice, this is about families and family unification as well. And so we're going to be doing things like issuing reports, having lobbying days on Capitol Hill. People will be able to participate from wherever they are, by contacting their elected officials, doing call-ins and letter writing and things of that nature. And so really staying connected with the network and with the campaign ongoing, because we are in this for the long haul. Like, you know, we have to keep advocating, keep fighting, keep bringing these issues to light, keep on holding governments accountable and then demanding change, right? And that's what the advocacy and the organizing is about.
Okay. Nanaz, quickly, if people wanted to get into contact with the organization that you represent, is there another website, or do they go to
the website? Sure, HaitianRefugees.org.
Okay, HaitianRefugees.org.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to mention, I know we didn't get to talk about the nationalization of Dominican mm-hmm. Haitian descent, but we also have a website. We have a boycott going on, a travel boycott, and there's a website called End Apartheid in the DR.
WordPress.com,
because this is apartheid.
And maybe we can have you back to have a conversation about that, but we appreciate your contributions for today. And as always, we appreciate Baji's contributions to the listening audience and to the program. Right. And we want to thank you both for being on our Beyond Borders, the peoples of the Caribbean and Latin America today.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, sister.
Thank you.
All right.